Good afternoon. You are watching the Q&A edition of Deprogram with Ted Rall and Jamal Thomas. And you might be like, wait, what happened to John Kiriakou? We will keep talking about that a little bit for the next couple of days, and then you'll just have to catch up if you haven't heard. So John's last day was Thursday. He let us know about an hour before Thursday's show that his new agency, CAA, told him that he's not allowed to do any more podcasts. So he's dropping Deep Focus as well as Deep Program. And I don't know, I guess he may or may not, he'll be probably cutting back his guest appearances so he can focus on this new TV deal that he's got out in Hollywood. And they told him that he can't do podcasts anymore. So that left us without a host, but, you know, it's a co-host, I should say. There was still me. I was, you know, it's funny, right before Jermall had, you had your health setback a couple of months ago, you and I had been talking about doing a show together anyway. So it was only natural that it was like, well, you know, you're better. You know, you're getting better, I think is a more accurate way to put it. You know, we were going to do a show together anyway. And, you know, it's just a natural fit. And I think it's going to be a pretty seamless transition, although obviously the dynamic won't be the same, nor should it be the same. Yep. But anyway, thanks so much. Jermall Thomas is the new co-host of Deep Program. And we had announced last week we were going to do Q&A Monday and Wednesday at 12 noon. So this is the second Q&A show. First one for Jermall, second for the show. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. Thanks for liking, following, and sharing the show. Please put your questions in the live chat at 12 noon Eastern time for the entire Here for the Hour, either in YouTube or in Rumble. And we're just going to answer the questions. No, if you have a question that involves today's news, we'll talk about today's news. But we're not the analysis show. Is at 9 a.m. Monday through Friday. Okay. Now,
there was a truth that came up about Bob Lazar in the previous one. Do you know who Bob Lazar is?
No.
You don't know Bob Lazar? Ted, you know Bob Lazar. Okay, so Area 51, you know Area 51?
Of course.
Bob Lazar is the guy that put Area 51 on the map. Like, Area 51, nobody knew that Area 51 existed before Bob Lazar came out effectively saying, oh my God, there's an alien craft. The U.S. government isn't testing these things.
Yeah.
And it became this huge story. Like, Bob Lazar became a cult classic. And he is one of the most controversial figures in the UFO lore. Because his story stayed consistent over the course of like 40 years, give or take. But you have a lot of critics who say, well, they think Bob Lazar is full of it. And you have a lot of people who say Bob Lazar is legit. Nevertheless, Bob Lazar stayed somewhat constant over the course of the time that he's been in the public spotlight. And to be honest, doesn't even like the public spotlight. They raided his businesses and all sorts of stuff looking for what they don't necessarily say what they're looking for. But Lazar is interesting. Lazar was recently on Rogan again, and is apparently coming out with a new documentary called S4, where he gives this almost like AI recreation of what it was like when he was at the base and stuff. His story is, this is one of those guys that I've known about for like 20 years. But it's good seeing him back into the limelight. And it is very wild seeing him on Rogan again. So somebody asked about it. Yeah.
Someone did. All right. And so we have questions already piled up in the queue. So are you ready?
Yeah.
All right. Meta Raislan, hey guys, there's a lot of contradictory reporting on the rescue operation. What do you think really happened? Yeah, I mean, you know, we're talking about the rescue of that pilot, which, by the way, I love the fact that, like, okay, so we're fighting a war that we shouldn't be fighting, and we're getting our economic asses handed to us, but somehow it's a huge victory that we lost a very expensive plane and a bunch of helicopters and another plane, apparently. The contradictory. So let's go through the contradictions. One is that two planes that were down one after another, one was
a Warthog, the other one was an F-15E Eagle, I believe.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. I mean, the story makes no sense. Let's be honest, right? This puts you to mind of you know, the Gilligan, the skipper, got on the SS Minnow and went and blew up Nord Stream Pipeline. And everybody's like, yeah, that makes sense. It's kind of like that. The story makes no sense. I mean, they're saying that Iran shot down their plane. Oh, I'm sorry. A plane went down, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. That the pilot lived, apparently.
Right.
Ragged himself like 1,000 miles or thousands of miles or something to that effect, hundreds of miles.
While injured.
100 miles, okay? While injured, by the way, in hostile territory. The U.S. sent, what was it? It was two Blackhawks or something like that?
Well, two Blackhawks, yes. Yeah.
According to the story, they got stuck, quote-unquote, in the sand. Those had to be blown up.
Shades of the 1980 hostage rescue mission under Jimmy Carter.
Yes, where it doesn't go well. Mm-hmm. Apparently, according to the story, they send hundreds of special forces deep inside of Iran in order to do the rescue operation. This just sounds so over the top.
Right. And I mean, this doesn't sound like a win to me. It's like, sounds to me like, you, and also there was a report that five Americans were killed in the rescue operation.
Yeah.
So, I mean, look, all that's clear is that nothing is clear. We're not being told the truth here. You know, it's like, look, this is not a complicated story. Like a certain number of planes and a certain number of people died. And like, what's that number? They're not telling us. These are integers. These are low. These are single digit integers. You should be able to answer these questions. Right. So what really happened? I don't know if we'll ever know. They say that truth is the first casualty of war, right? Matina, question. What are Jamal's political views? In other words, where is he coming from? Great question.
I come from the left. I tend to be an honest lefty. And I put the term honest in it because, you know, a person could be on the left and still be full of it. Look, I try to give you my honest take, and I'm not partisan in this case, if that makes sense. Obviously, I have certain political views, and those views tend to trend towards less or, you know, non-interventionalism, if that's the word, but I'll go with it, under normal circumstances, but I'm not a pacifist per se. And so, look, I tend to be straight with you, and I tend to argue or give you my take or my point of view, like where my point of view is coming from. You can pick it apart. Agree with it or disagree with it, but I will be straight with you. And if I think I'm wrong, I'll just say I'm wrong, or I think I'm wrong. I don't typically have a dog in the hunt on this stuff, but I tend to float economically to the left. Not just float, I tend to be hardcore to the left in economics. And the same thing is probably true, like from the standpoint of foreign policy. I tend to be less interventionist. Unless I feel like somebody's about to be attacked or assaulted, I tend to shy away from this idea of invading countries and blowing stuff up, which is why I'm so against the behavior that has been taking place now and has been taking place for the United States over the course of this arc of history. So I don't know. You can spot check me on that stuff when it comes up. But I will give you my honest take. So.
Yeah, I mean, that's what this show is about, right? Like it's the tradition of this show has been you know, to try to call it as we see it, regardless, you know, like we're not pushing an agenda here, right? Like if Donald Trump does something great, and he does sometimes, I'll say so, you know, and so vice versa, you know, if whatever. So like basically no agenda, just, you know, whatever, just call it as we see it. No team politics here.
Same thing. I mean, I have plenty of videos where I'm like, hey, good job, Trump.
Yeah.
And people are like, oh my God, I can't believe you said that.
I've been there.
But I think I'm going to have other videos where I'm putting a knife in them vigorously. And I got to be honest, there are more of those videos than the others. But if he does something good, I give him credit. I don't have an issue saying, hey, getting rid of the TPP was a good thing.
Right. Agreed. I agree with that too. Evan, what genre of movies is y'all's favorite and which movies?
Sci-fi. Easy, sci-fi.
Sci-fi is a hard genre, though. The average quality level is lower than, like, say, drama.
Well, okay, like Tenet is an example, like a Gary Nolan flick.
I paid $20 to watch Tenet because it came out during the pandemic, and it was like the first, and it was like, it's $20. You want to watch a new movie? And we'd all been at home, and it's like, okay, I'll fucking pay. And I'm like, actually, $20 at home. It's not a $20 movie. Anyway.
You don't think so? The movie is fantastic. I even bought that movie.
I slept through it.
What?
Yeah. I did not care for it at all.
What was it that you didn't like about it? Because to me, Tenet was phenomenal.
I thought the pacing didn't work, first and foremost. Uh-huh. I often have problems with pacing of films. you know, it's like, it's either there or it's not. But so sci-fi genre, I mean, I do look, some of my favorite films are sci-fi for sure. I mean, yeah. I can't count the number of times I've seen RoboCop, Starship Troopers. I love Verhoeven, you know, love him. I think he's an international treasure. If I have to say my all-time genre, favorite genre is probably noir or French New Wave. But I also love, I mean, love sci-fi, but it's a disappointing category a lot of the time. There's a lot of schlock.
A lot of times it is, because they lean so far on special effects. Cloud Atlas.
By the way, I just watched Blade Runner, the original one, again.
And the sequel, I love.
So did you know it was set in, so this is funny, I just noticed this, it was last week. It's set in 2019, and Harrison Ford, he has a newspaper, because even in in the 80s, they couldn't imagine that in 2019 there still wouldn't be newspapers.
Interesting.
Right?
See, that's the rub, right? I don't know if you've ever seen these guys who do, what is it called? Like remote viewing. Mm-hmm. And when they're doing like the future. And like the people will point out, they would be like, you know, that's always hard. Like even futurists, like people who predict that stuff, because you never know. Like if you were in,
of course, it's really hard.
1912, you couldn't conceive of anything like the internet, right? Like it's hard to get your head around it. And even if you could look into the future, mm-hmm. you would have no words to even explain what it is. And that's just what, 60 years, 50, 60 years, 70 years, 100 years, give or take.
Yeah. I think about that. My dad is born in 1928. And, you know, just think about what his world was like when he was, yeah. I mean, like, you know, no one had a television set. Rich people didn't have a television set.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like in radio was your main broadcast medium. You know, a city like New York had 26 daily newspapers. I mean, it was a very, very different world.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's see. Okay.
Oh, by the way, Spotless Sunshine of the, I do like drama also. Spotless, what is it called? Spotless and the Jim Carrey thing of the Sunless Mind. I can't even.
Yeah, the Spotless Mind, the Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
That's it. I love that film. That is
filmed in my old stomping grounds of Eastern Long Island.
Is that where they filmed?
Yeah, it's filmed in Montauk. US XXX A-Rod. Yeah, have Jermall intro himself a little more and talk about his journalistic background. Good idea.
Journalistic? I don't know if I could call myself a journalist. So I started maybe about a little bit more than a decade ago on YouTube under Jermall Thomas, my channel. And initially, it was just kind of feeling my way out. I think this was during the Bernie Sanders wave. And I started paying more attention to politics, especially getting into like a Professor Wolfian type world view, like a workable point of view, and would do my show in that sense. That led to me getting the job at the radio network of Sputnik, where I was there for 5 or 6 years. And we covered domestic and international politics. In fact, man, they've sent me to so many events because I was one of those people who just used to love to travel. So if I could do both travel and work, yeah, man, hello. I covered the Geneva thing with Joe Biden and Putin when they were at that meeting. I covered the European parliamentary elections, Lula elections. I was sent on all of these places in order to cover them on the ground. And at the point where the network went belly up, reformatted my channel to resemble the radio program that I worked on, covering international and domestic politics. So this has been something that I've been doing for the last decade. I don't want to be long-winded, but that's as just a brief synopsis of.
Okay, plenty more to get to. Did we really, Skylasky wants to ask, did we really recover both pilots on the downed planes with no losses of American soldiers? Well, we talked about that a little bit.
Yep.
I'm 50% or more convinced that we lost some soldiers in the rest. Yeah.
I think he's just lying. I think so this too. Is just, you know, it looks bad that you Because let's put it in context, right?
We were told these planes couldn't be shot down. We had total dominance of the skies.
And right? We were told that Iran no longer had air defense.
Right.
How does that work? Right.
Yeah, that's not like, possible.
Oh, they had air defense. This war is over. And all of a sudden, this.
Yeah. Like, that's not possible, right? It's like, if anything, yeah. Iran, like, I had talked about this earlier, and I think this was borne out to be correct. Iran clearly, they knew that this was going to be like an existential, longer battle, a war than the one a year ago. Right. And they obviously used their shitty missiles up front, and they're improving them as time goes on, which is exactly what you and I would do.
Right.
You know, it's like, you know, save the best for last. And then also psychologically, right, it's like, oh, shit, this isn't getting easier. This is getting worse for your right. enemy. So
yeah.
we haven't even seen the hypersonics yet.
By the way, it's what Russia did, too. If you remember, mm-hmm. they started augmenting their dum-dum bombs with, like, gliders.
Yeah.
So those bombs could effectively glide further and hit those targets, like, as guided bombs. Yeah, Iran did the same. And it's rational. It's like, okay, well, this guy has X amount of air defense. So he has 20 missiles. Mm-hmm. All right, let's see if he can shoot down 400.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are dummies. Some of them are the dumb missiles. And at some point, when you realize, okay, their air defense system is effectively weakening and giving out, oh, here's a new hypersonic. Here's another missile. It's like you're introducing those things in a way to deplete the capability of the enemy, in this case, their air defense systems. Not to mention the air defense system didn't seem to be all that great anyway. Like, or at the very least, they seem to be diminishing because Iran has been hitting Israel seemingly at will at this point.
Yeah. It's the Ginsu knife strategy, right? Like, but wait,
yeah.
There's more.
right.
Yezdi, thanks for the 200 rupees. I think those are rupees. Hey, Ted and Robbie, extremely sad to hear about John not being able to do the show anymore. That being said, the show must carry on, and it's lovely to see Jarmal on the show.
Agreed? Oh, thank you.
Hey, TC Ponte, what do you think of the dispensationalist theology in the Trump government? Could it be related to the recent change in army leadership, e.g. refusal to follow absurd and illegal orders? I mean, I do think the purge in the army is of note for a variety of reasons, and not just because we're in the middle of a hot war, and it's weird to switch out the army chief of staff in the middle of a hot war. But, you know, we haven't talked about this, Jarmal, but I mean, I think the militarization of ICE, you know, turning ICE into the biggest militarized force in the United States, bigger than the standing U.S. Army, bigger than the national army militaries of whole nations like Denmark or Norway, is an ominous possible hint to what might look like an election cancellation this fall. And I wonder if Trump is trying to install a more compliant military in preparation for full-on fascism.
I think he's trying to install a compliant military in general, but that had, I think people need to put that in context, what you just said. Like, what is it, the Posse Comitatus Act, the one that basically said you can't have U.S. military.
Posse Comitatus, yeah.
Posse Comitatus. And then what they've did was effectively find an end run around it. And so, okay, fair enough. We can't do quote-unquote military, but that doesn't necessarily stop us from creating other organizations that functions almost as a domestic military and use that at our leisure. Because if you think about it, like, it's not like if ICE has rules, I'm unclear what those are. Because the way it functions in practice is that they seemingly can get away with anything.
It's a paramilitary organization.
It is.
It's familiar to anybody who's been overseas and seen countries that have paramilitaries.
Yeah. And by the way, he is doing that. I mean, the fact that he's putting military or, let's say, trying to put troops on U.S. soil, that is ominous. Ominous.
Very. Yeah. And I mean, look, they're already at U.S. airports.
Yep.
John Harth, thoughts on Lindsey Graham talking about the invasion of Karg Island as Iwo Jima-esque? why romanticize Iwo Jima? We lost so many Marines on the beaches. Excited for the new journey this show will be on. Yeah, I don't know why Lindsey Graham would be talking about that. Iwo Jima was a meat grinder.
Right.
This probably will be, probably just because it's an island off the coast of off your adversary. I think he's that dim-witted.
Oh, he is. I mean, I was about to say something derogatory to Lindsey Graham, but Lindsey Graham is a lunatic.
There's probably nothing more derogatory that you could say about him that John didn't say.
Yeah. Right. Oh, for real. See, yeah. I don't know the boundaries.
Mrs. Lindsey Graham or, you know, her. Or,
yeah, but Miss Lindsey,
yeah,
it seems to have an emasculation complex, mm-hmm. And just like John McCain, where it's like, look, I think these people are psychopaths or sociopaths. I don't think they care in the context about human life in the realest sense of the term. And it seems that there's no war that Lindsey Graham is not perfectly capable of sending other people's kids to go die at. And so I don't know why he would romanticize. I mean, the Japanese islands were vicious fights. Like, these weren't, these kind of triumphant, easy wins.
No.
He romanticizes that nonsense.
Absolutely brutal. I would recommend watching Letters from Iwo Jima and Letters from Our Fathers. The pair, really brilliantly done. You need to watch both.
Yeah.
Get a sense of that. Mustafa, thanks for the $1.99. Much appreciated. Hi Jamal. Welcome to the show from Annie. Anna, how much truth do you think there is to the miracle rescue story of the F-15s? Did they really get rescued? Ish. TCKE, any thoughts or insight into the Bubiyan missile and drone strike by Iran? Evidently, the base was a relocation site for the U.S. troops from Camp Arfjan.
Right.
I'll look into that. I don't know.
Well, they've been reshaping the Middle East in regards to the Gulf countries, which is one of the most fascinating parts of this conflict. Like, they got into a conflict believing, seemingly anyway, that Iran was going to continue with the true promise thing. Like, oh, we'll do a fake. Okay, or we'll respond modestly. Okay, we'll respond a little bit more. Like, it seems that they had this kind of assessment that Iran wouldn't lose its mind and go bananas. What they miss is that Iran had no choice but to go bananas.
Exactly.
So this notion that we can continuously peck at you.
Yeah.
And when we stop, everything stops until we reload and peck at you again is nonsense.
And it's like October 7th. I mean, Hamas was like, we're not a lawn to be mown, right? Like,
right.
We're coming for you now.
Right. You have royally screwed the pooch. In the way that you've approached this. They didn't have a choice. Look, they are in a situation where they are dealing with an existential threat. And let's be very clear, it is existential. I mean, if you look at what the United States did to all of those countries leading up to Iran, where you go into Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Libya, which they've been invading and trying to take territory from. Like, basically, you have had a monster roaming through the woods. And that monster roaming through the woods has been knocking on Iran's door for the last God knows how long.
And it's so ironic because everything that the U.S. says about Iran, Iran could say about the U.S., right? Like, someone's got to fucking take out the trash at some point. I think if I'm Iran, the message that I'm sending out to the Sunni countries is, well, you guys were sucking the Americans' dicks. Like, we're standing tall. And I think that's got to speak to the Arab street.
You would think. I mean, you would hope that they would look at it in those terms. I think on some level it does. Otherwise, the Gulf states wouldn't act the way that they do. Like, meaning
they're scared of their own people.
Exactly. Like, the language comes across as if, hey, we're working with Iran. We're not going to work with America, blah, blah, blah. And in practice, though, Saudi Arabia was obviously helping the states, helping the U.S. All these states were helping the U.S.
Yeah, MBS was behind the scenes urging Trump to attack Iran.
I saw that report. Yeah, I saw that report. And again, I'm not shocked. Saudi Arabia to me was always sketchy.
Oh.
I think I even had Mirani on when I was like,
they're the worst.
These guys, do you? Yeah.
Like, we should have nothing to do with them at all. Okay, so let's see. Thanks very much, USXXX A-Rod, for the donation. That being said, why are none of the military brass standing up to Hegseth and the president? They have to know that what they're demanding now is insane.
It's not their job to stand up. I mean, no. You could say it's their job. I don't know if it works that way in practice. Usually they follow orders, right?
Yeah, or John used to say that if Trump tried to like cancel elections, that the military would stand up against him. I always disagreed with him. I don't think so. I think they're everything. Every atom in their being is trained to just say yes, sir, and just follow orders. And I know they're told like, oh, you know, you don't have to follow an unlawful order. But in reality, if you avail yourself of that privilege, you end up in being court-martialed.
You can be prosecuted. Yeah. I mean, look at what took place in Venezuela, right? Like, they were literally just murdering people in boats. All of those orders were illegal.
Yeah.
By our laws, international laws, it didn't...
And clearly illegal.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not like, murdering this guy falls on the edge of legality. It's just illegal, right?
No.
Didn't stop them from doing it. They still followed their orders. And even when one of the guys, I forget the name of the general, the person who's running it, is basically retired early because there were illegal orders, they still did it.
Well, I mean, you know, what we forget is that Ronald Reagan signed Executive Order 12333, which bans political assassinations like that of General Soleimani. And it's completely still in effect. No president has ever canceled it. They just ignore it. Robbie had a question for you, for us.
Yeah, regarding the shoot down of those American planes.
Yeah.
I can't prove it. I was going to bounce this off of you. What do you think the odds are that Russia's not officially involved? What do you think the odds are that they sent some of their Wagner buddies over there? They're the ones who are playing hell over there in Iran.
Oh, that's interesting.
That's what interesting, I would do.
Right?
It's possible.
I mean, how else are they doing it? We know that the Russians are giving the Iranians targeting information. We know that they're assisting with logistics. So why wouldn't they send Wagner? I mean, what other?
By the way, Colonel Wilkerson said the same thing. Because Wilkerson's thing was there'll probably be Russian pilots in some of those planes.
Yeah, why wouldn't there be?
Like, because you're in this kind of fog of war where you can kind of get away with this. Like perfect example. In the very beginning of the war in Ukraine, there were reports coming out of, I think it was Figueroa, a French newspaper, that there were troops, U.S. troops, and French troops on the ground in Ukraine. Now, they would never acknowledge this in the sense of, hey, we have troops fighting on behalf of France against the Russians. But are they? You know what I mean? Like, you have every incentive in the world to basically drag America into a larger quagmire of its own making, considering it was a self-inflicted error. No, I agree with you. It probably is. It may not be Wagner, but it may be some other contingent of military.
No, I mean, it happens. You know, my grandfather, he lied about his age. He's born in 1905, went to go fight in France when he was about 12, 13.
Yeah.
And then they fought
it. Lincoln Brigade, is that what it's called?
Oh, no, this is called the Confederate Brigade because it's all guys from the South. They flew Confederate battle flags over their trenches, and their commanding officer was this dude in the 70s who was a former Confederate officer.
What?
And we've got this old wax record. It's about a quarter of an inch thick. It's this old cylinder, and it's in France. It's called You'll Find Dixieland in France. It's not in any of the history books, but we've got the record.
Wow. I didn't know that, by the way. I knew about the Abraham.
Yeah, no one does.
What the Confederate one?
I love stuff like that. It's so esoteric. Thanks, Robbie. Okay, so let's see. What's the country? This is from Daniel that you visited that disappointed you guys the most, or would never visit again? I love that question.
Oh, I hate that question. I don't want to answer that question.
I'll answer that question.
I hate that question.
All right. So I fucking hate Japan. And I fucking hate South Korea more. So South Korea is boring. There's really not much to do. The people are not friendly. But Japan, there's stuff to do, but the people are so unfriendly. I mean, you're just not going to get a connection with anyone. And I used to go all the time because I worked for a Japanese bank. So it's not like I went once and had a bad time. I went more times than I could count. And it sucks. Pakistan, there's stuff to do, but it's fucking, I mean, it's hot, it's miserable, everyone's addicted to drugs, they hate Americans, they throw rocks at you when they see you go by in a Jeep or whatever. The pollution's fucking out of this world. Everything smells awful. It's dangerous as shit. So I fucking hated Pakistan. I'm trying to think what other countries I would like. So I would go to Pakistan again because there's business there. You know, like in my, because I care about Central and South Asia, but I wouldn't, you know, if I could avoid going to South Korea or Japan, I would.
You would. Mm-hmm. Believe it or not, I actually love Japan. It maybe it's because
a lot of people do.
Yeah, it's clean.
It is.
Food is great. Safe. There's also stuff to do. Yeah, it's safe, radically so. Yeah, it's an interesting place to visit. The subways are just phenomenal, like in the way that they can move your cities and stuff like that, or the very least specific to Tokyo. I didn't like India.
India's rough.
Yeah, I didn't like India.
I'd go back to India again, though. The people are great.
Yeah, it wasn't the people. It was just, it's rubbed against my sensibilities. Like for example, I was there 18 years ago. And, you know, it's like, it's hot. At the time, they didn't have a trash system that I was aware of.
Yeah.
And so the trash would just bake on the streets.
Oh,
and
it's so the squalor is crazy.
It would be like 100 degrees with trash baking in the streets in the middle of the monsoons.
And it's piled like a foot or two high everywhere.
Yes. It's gross. Like, it just grossed me out.
Like, there doesn't seem to be trash pickup.
At the time, there wasn't.
Yeah, people just throw their shit out on the street. That's it.
Yeah. It was just like, you would just see streets full of trash. Many of the streets weren't paved at the time I was there. And so it's like, when you're walking from point A to point B, you're effectively walking in, you know, none. Street. I don't know. It just it rubbed against my sensibilities. I put it that way.
Yeah. India is rough for sure. Good question though. Okay, let's see.
I don't like the trash countries. That's Faze, what I like.
Faze is asking, where is John? John quit an hour before Thursday's show because his new agency told him to. He has a Hollywood deal. And they said, oh, you're not going to have time to do anything but write your TV show. So we're telling you, you have to quit all your podcasts. So he's quitting Deep Focus. He's quitting this. He quit this. So that's where John is. The pilots, were they women? I don't know.
Yeah, that I don't know. I thought it was a colonel. They were saying it was a guy, I thought.
The rescued dude was a dude. Rescued guy was a guy.
Okay.
Blank. Can you guys show current political cartoons or talk about political cartoons sometimes? Sure, but if you're really into that, you should watch the DMZ America podcast with me and Scott Stantis. That's Thursdays at 11 a.m. Eastern. Matina, this may be a delicate question. How does Jermall get his news if he can't see?
No, I didn't say I was blind.
That whole distinction of legally blind versus blind, you know.
Yeah, I'm not legally blind. I'm not blind. My vision has just been damaged. Like, so, like, for example, my right eye has, like, it's almost like you're looking through a straw. It's almost like you're looking through a straw. And this other stuff is blurry. And so it becomes that much more difficult to, not to mention there's a hole in my eyesight also. So there's a segment of it right there. There's a segment of it missing. And it's like a chunk that's, that if anything falls in it, it just kind of disappears. Your brain tries to ignore that and tries to piece the world together using whatever vision you have remaining into kind of a cohesive picture of the world. It's not that I'm blind, not able to drive at the moment. Playing chess and stuff like that is more difficult, but you can still do it. I mean, you can still function. It's just more difficult to function. But yeah, it's awkward. I haven't gotten used to it yet. I still nearly run into stuff. Well, miss stuff when I'm like reaching for it or like pouring and you're pouring in the, on the floor or stuff like that.
Have they told you it's going to get better? Or?
I have no expectation of it getting better. In fact, I assumed that it was permanent the moment that it happened. Because 5 years ago, something like this happened where I wake up and I am blind. Like, and I mean blind, like where like 70, like all of the vision in one eye is gone, 75% of it in the other eye is gone. And in a panic, instead of asking my wife at the time, can you take me to the ER? Because I've had a stroke. I effectively tell her, I'm going to the hospital. And giving her a few seconds, I just kind of leave, get in the car and drive to the hospital. And they basically say you had a stroke. But at that time, it was only like a sliver of vision that was lost. And I got to be honest, even with that sliver, I went through a full panic. Like I had a meltdown over the, I mean, it took a while for me to kind of even just deal with the fact that the vision was impacted at all. And this is radically worse. No, I assumed it was permanent, especially when it didn't go away after a day or so, because I was traveling for that about 2 days to get back into the States. And at no point did it come back. If anything, it just is what it is. I'm going to a eye specialist here in Richmond. They don't necessarily know what to put it down to yet. They're thinking it may be something with the retina. I do know it has something to do with hypotension, like low blood pressure. Like when the blood pressure gets worse, the vision gets worse.
So is this officially like, is this like a TEI or whatever that's called? Or is it's an acronym for like a micro stroke.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I got to be honest. Like they checked the brain. Nothing took place in the brain. And to be honest, they may even find at the end of it all, well, this wasn't necessarily a stroke in the strictest sense of the term. It was something else that affected the retina that affected blah, 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 blah. The previous doctor called it a stroke. So that's the terminology I went with because it seemed that there was pinching off or a blockage of something that created some weirdness with the vision. But the weak spot seemed to be vision.
So much for fucking intelligent design.
I know.
Like you could be just hanging out and suddenly, you know, this something gets pinched.
But that's the terrifying part. You could be like, look, you can do anything, right? And something goes wrong. And it just, and sometimes it feels random.
Yeah, it's so weird. Okay, thanks for the donation, Jose Miranda, $4.99. What are your thoughts on birthright citizenship being overturned? Uh-oh. And do you think it will happen? Let's put in Robbie here because I know Robbie likes to talk about birthright citizenship. I have to say, I don't think it's going to happen for the simple reason that the Supreme Court, which used to be so hard to read during their oral arguments 20 years ago, you couldn't tell shit. But now you totally can tell how they're going to vote from the way they ask the questions. And it's pretty clear you're going to have like a 7-2 roughly majority opposing Trump's executive order. And but, you know, the thing is, what's interesting is that the Supreme Court in a ruling that like people like glided by last year basically has decided that like, now when they adjudicate a case that applies to sort of a general class, it only applies to the actual plaintiff. Right. Nobody knows this. So it used
Wait,
to be.
What do you mean? Explain that.
Well, so for example, like say there's the like now. Let's say you had like the Colorado gay cake case where the guy like so if that case had come around now, they would have ruled in his favor, but it would not do any good to anyone else who was in the same exact position that he's in. It would only apply to him, and anyone else who was in the same position would have to go back and seek redress from the courts individually. It used to be that, like, if you, you know, whatever, whether you're a Dred Scott or Korematsu or whoever, you know, whatever situation happened to you, now that court ruling applies to everyone in your situation, unless it's a decertified decision like Bush v. Gore. But
there's case law. I mean, it still creates case law, right?
It not the way it used to. Not really. I mean, it does create case law at the lower level, but if it makes its way all the way back to the Supremes, they kind of consider it de novo, which is the term, like basically like it was never there before.
And one ruling overrules the other in a kind of a weird sense.
Totally. Yeah, it's very strange. So so in a weird way, the Trump administration is likely to de facto have overturned birthright citizenship without getting it officially back. So anyone who is having birthright citizenship stripped by the federal government can avail themselves of the courts, but they're going to have to spend like $10 million to win their case, even though the truth is they should win their case because the Constitution is pretty clear.
Is it? Explain that to me.
Okay, go ahead, Robbie. I'm sorry.
Robbie, yeah. Joe.
Well, it's not clear. I mean, let's put this into context. The 14th Amendment was ratified after the War of Northern Aggression. That's what happened. The entire purpose. Listen, I'm talking to a black man right here. Okay, totally fearless.
No, go ahead, Robbie.
And yeah. here's the whole issue. It was about extending, making sure that slaves and their children had citizenship. That was the entire point.
That's right.
Of it. It had nothing to do with immigration. Now, it's a horribly written amendment. I mean, whoever wrote it was drunk, retarded, dropped as a baby. I have no idea. They're just badly written. But history's on my side here. Because in the 1860s, the Dakota Territories, Indian Territories were all under the jurisdiction of the United States government. No other country on this earth claimed them. That's a statement.
But they were considered sort of semi-autonomous nation states by the federal government.
No, they weren't. I mean, they were just there. But the point that I'm making is that Indians who were born, in the tribal nations didn't have American citizenship, even though they were under the jurisdiction.
No, because of what I just said.
Yeah, they were tribal nations. Like, it's not like meaning those places weren't the U.S. Those places weren't America.
And they still kind of aren't, right? I mean, like, the government needs to get permission from, like, Navajo Nation leadership to go onto the res.
Right.
The United States never recognized any of those. Like, they go through and they make treaties, like the Fort Laramie and stuff. They go in, they play games and stuff. But it was a very Byzantine, very British way, just trying to go through and try and bribe them and give them the blankets, whatever, give them as much booze. They wipe each other out as much as they can with alcoholism.
That's all true. But under the U.S. Constitution, a treaty obligation is a recognition. You don't sign a treaty with something that's not a nation.
I agree. Right. So it is on you. The only treaty I can think of that was ever actually ratified by the U.S. Congress was at the end of Red Cloud's war, when Red Cloud defeated the United States for the very first time. Like, the U.S. Congress never signed a treaty with the Creeks or the Cherokees or the Sioux or anyone else. That was the Department of Interior going through making agreements. That's where you get the whole idea of a rules-based order versus a law-based order. They were never recognized as nations. Those people were a nuisance. And the whole point that I'm making here with this from a historical context is that you cannot bestow citizenship on someone who comes over here, who's 9 months pregnant, pops a squat, fires out junior, the baby's a citizen, when you had an entire race of people who are already here, and those citizenship rights were not given to those people either. What needs to happen?
But that's different because I said they were tribal nations.
Yeah.
Okay. Then show me where Congress ever recognized them. Show me where the United States ever set up an embassy
by signing treaties with them. Those treaties were ratified by Congress.
No, they weren't. They were done by the Department of the Interior. Fact check me on this.
Okay, well, they should have been ratified by Congress.
Well, should have and were are two very different things.
But the point is, they did sign a treaty, right? So, and I guess
it wasn't lawful. I mean, again, under the Constitution, only Congress can sign a treaty. That's why, for example, if this whole thing going through with Iran, if I was ever made the Grand Baptist Ayatollah of Iran, I would insist, as part of the peace agreement, that Congress sign a treaty.
Agreed.
Codifying in law. The only Indian, to my knowledge, that ever got a treaty, got through Congress, was Red Cloud. When he went to Washington, D.C., he met with Congress. He went to the Capitol. He did all these things because he defeated the United States Army. And that was a problem that they did not need.
But Robbie, legally, aside from the legal, I mean, we have other questions waiting, so I don't want to spend the whole show on this. But we've talked about the problems that are created by not having birthright citizenship. For example, someone's brought here as luggage when they're 1 year old. They don't even speak their quote unquote native language. They only speak English. They only play American video games. They play Baldur's Gate. They watch Robbie West's gaming channel. They're completely American. So it's nonsensical to suggest that this person should go back to Uruguay or whatever. Yeah. It makes no sense at all. And they're supposed to live in the shadows here. And then they have kids, and then their kids are illegal too. In France, they have this problem. And you have fourth generation illegal immigrants. That makes no fucking sense.
Then the case that you need to make, and I hear what you're saying, I understand the argument. Then the case that you need to make then is that you have to pass a law through Congress, signed by the president, and you have to make the case how immigration, legal or illegal, helps me economically. You're both economically to the left of me. So the biggest problem that we have is wage suppression and rising inflation. Immigration is a net drain on wages.
They're related, but they're not the same issue, Robbie, right?
But it's all tied in together. So the point that you have to make then, is that you have to explain to me how this is a good thing, and call me a racist isn't going to make it work. You have to make the case.
It's not about race. I mean, you're stuck with the birthright citizenship thing. Like, I understand. Look, you can make an argument to me that this too much immigration creates a depression of wages. You can make that argument. But the issue, more so than anything else, is it's a constitutional issue.
Yeah,
Trump administration, regardless of what you feel about it, and regardless of what it may have been used as, because I disagree with you on the travel thing. I think those things weren't part of the United States. And so at the case where it's like, well, we didn't let these people in. Well, those people weren't technically part of the United States, in essence. I mean, the United States was fighting for territory going all the way to the West. The thing I'm getting at, though, is it is part of the Constitution, though, whether it's the letter of it or whether it's the intent. I mean, fuck's sake. We're stuck with the Second Amendment, right?
Right.
And it's not like we're building militias. And yet they still use it under this idea of everybody has a right to bear arms up to a bazooka and up to missiles. Nonsense. Like, just in the same way that I'm stuck with the Second Amendment, which should be tweaked, we're stuck with the citizenship thing. To be honest.
I mean, we ignore the Second Amendment all the time. Every gun control law in the country is unconstitutional. They should all be thrown out and nullified. But to kind of take it a step further,
I have a missile launcher in my backyard?
Why not? If you can afford it, go for it. I should be able to go to Walmart, buy a tank.
And you, as my neighbor, should be perfectly okay with me having a missile launcher in my backyard.
Listen, I'll go out there and help you shoot the sucker. Yeah, 100%. Absolutely.
Just don't let your dog piss on your lawn.
But Robbie, I will tell you, most people would not be okay with me doing that.
The vast majority of people are stupid. So I understand the argument that you're making, but it all comes down to, at the end of the day, is the Constitution a dead document or a living one? I think that's really what – I think it's the living biggest – it's a dead one. It's a dead one.
Alexander Hamilton was really clear.
You think the Constitution is a dead document?
100%.
Oh, I so disagree with
that. That's not what the founders wanted.
Of course it is, because that's why I have the ability to that's why we have the ability to go in and amend the Constitution. It has to be able to be changed. It's not holy writ. I mean, and Ted, I've told you this before, and I'm a creature of the right. I think that the Constitution that we currently have is woefully in need of being replaced, because the world in which it was written no longer exists. This is not 13 agrarian colonies. This is a transcontinental empire.
We got to move on. But let me just say, I want to get the last word on this, just because I'm going to be a jerk about it.
You're the host.
I think that, it's like, it's totally possible. I'm in favor of carefully controlled borders, which we have not had as well, because you're not a nation state without it. And that, like, we have to deal with the people who came in under the previous policies and we have to be humane to them and treat them with dignity and respect as much as possible.
100%. Listen, I want mass deportations on a massive scale done in a humane manner. Like, for example, if you're here from Guatemala, I don't want to send you to South Sudan. That's not what
you came here when you were one. You shouldn't be sent back. Okay, we've got
to help send your ass back. Man, woman, and child, you're gone.
Because there's no back.
There sure is.
It's not. You're not. You're not Bye. From there. You're not from there.
Goodbye.
All right. Well,
you're going back.
Jermall and Robbie and Ted, what are your thoughts on transhumanism and Neuralink?
Oh, that's super interesting. So it is very it is a very dubious prospect to me to put a microchip in my head that a company that I'm supposed to trust because you're putting it in my head.
To put it mildly.
Yeah, to put it mildly, right? And yet, it will happen. Like, I guarantee you. Because what's going to end up happening is that for few people who get it are going to be for medical stuff. This person is blind. This person can't move a limb. This person is et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And those people, just in the development of the technology, may develop some level of advantages associated with having it. Hell, you may have memory storage. Maybe you have, enhancements in some particular capacity. In which case, it may be advantageous in order to get it. And if it becomes advantageous to get it, it will spread. But beware.
I could see athletic implications. Athletic.
But again, buyer beware. Like, the moment that you have something in your head like that, what if there's a bug? Mm-hmm. Like you know, think of perceptual issues where you're thinking, oh my God, a UFO is landing and I'm being abducted. And really, it's just a bug in the microchip that they've implanted in your head, right? Insane. I don't know, man. That stuff is very – I get it. I don't know if human beings are as flexible as the transhumanists think they are. I believe human beings are flexible. I believe they're flexible slowly. But I think – they may run into hard limits in regards to this merger between man and machine and how far people are willing to
talk about future shock.
At least in the short term, you know, over spans of time, who knows what takes place.
I think it's satanic. I think it goes back to that old lie.
You say you think it's satanic?
I think it's satanic. It's okay. Well, because it goes back to that old lie that that Satan told Adam and Eve back in the garden. He said, no, eat of this fruit and you shall be as gods. And I think that's really what this is just trying to blend the line between the physical and the metaphysical, trying to make – here's the problem with human beings is that we are too proud to ever admit, corporately, not individually, but corporately, that we don't know what we don't know. And that's the biggest problem with science is that the power that you get isn't earned.
But it is earned.
You pick up with what – someone did before you without any work or sacrifice on your own. And so you just keep pushing that edge. You keep pushing that edge. And then I think what really where it starts to kind of break down is when it comes down to ethics. If we're going to start going through and we're going to start experimenting with this technology, well, who are going to be the guinea pigs? It's going to be the most vulnerable people in society. It's going to be the really young. It's going to be the old. It's going to be the mentally challenged. And that's the whole issue where does progress become abuse?
No, I get that. But is that true? I mean, like, the reality of it is if you're getting, think of it today, let's say petty transhumanism. Somebody goes to get their lips done, their ass done, their breasts done. They get cheek implants. They get eye implants. Who's paying for that? That's the rich. That's not random person. You know, who's poor and is barely making ends.
Yeah, it's not covered by insurance.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Sitting ahead.
So, it's not covered by insurance. Yeah, it's like.
Yeah, it has to be rich, right? Yeah. So if you're talking about who's getting the Neuralink, okay, they're probably putting it in chips and dogs and whatever else, chipmunks. But invariably, insurance is not paying for that. Like, those are things that people are going to have to pay out of pocket for. Now, I could be wrong on this. This, like, the more extreme cases of the stuff, especially when you talk about, like, some of the stuff that the Nazis were doing for medicine and everything else.
Or the Japanese. What the Japanese did in China was so much worse than what the Nazis did.
Yes.
The Unit 731 stuff. Yeah.
Yep.
And saying that's the problem, right, is that once you open that box, where does it stop? Mm-hmm. I would rather keep the box closed and never open it. There's a line that you should never, ever, ever cross. Because once you do,
this is not religious and this is not metaphysical. The changes that they're making are physical. It's not like they're teaching somebody to be a psychic.
I think that we should go a little slower. I think there should be some sort of, I mean, you know, we're a world of beta testers, right? I mean, I think it's like they basically, I mean, literally they just loosen self-driving cars onto the streets of major cities without any, like, they never even had like a fake town, like in the middle of Nevada where they tested them. And it's like, what the fuck? Like, you know, like there's some kind of, you know, like, hey, let's take a beat and see if we're ready here, you know?
Yeah, it just said, fuck it.
Let's study this. Jamal, great question from Ray. Are you ever going to stream your show on Rumble?
I used to stream it on Rumble. It just didn't do well.
Well, I don't have an issue. That's going to change. We were talking, Robbie and I were talking with you about that. Yes. Let's bang through a couple more of these and then we'll call it an hour. CR Card. Well, hello, Jamal. Long time no see. You're the person who started me down the road of seriously looking at geopolitics. I don't know if I should thank you or thank you or shake my fist at you. It's a joke.
A little bit of both.
Let's see. Okay. Oh, yeah, we can. Jamal, wasn't Malik in a hospital commercial on a gurney? I remember seeing an ad to watch Fault Lines on Rumble way back when.
Was he? That I don't know. What?
It's an don't ad. Know. Did you get diarrhea when you went to India? You know, I don't think I did. I don't think I did. Man, Central Asia, though. I lost 42 pounds. I shot it all out.
Did you? No, see, I avoided anything that wasn't. Yeah, I avoided drinking.
And Amber stuff like saying, that. John said he wasn't quitting Deep Focus. Let's just say I have not heard that from John. That's all I'm going to say that. Which country gave you the worst diarrhea? Central Asia, for me, for sure.
See, I never got diarrhea. Well, slightly in Egypt, but that was because I washed my fruit. But that wasn't bad, though.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, avoid water, avoid salad, avoid washing your fruit.
Technically, New Orleans is part of the United States, but it's really a different country. That was it for me.
True, true. Robbie, and this will make this one the last one. As a native, y'all Euro immigrants have been by far a bigger nuisance to this continent than the sovereign nations who existed before the U.S. for tens of thousands of years.
Okay, I'm going to push back just a little bit. First, I am a Native American. My family came here in the 1600s. I was born here. Nine generations of my people were here. We founded this country. Sorry, there's no such thing as the United States before 1776. So. You're wrong there. Also, want to just point out some things. We brought you the wheel. We brought you the combustive engine. We brought you agriculture. We brought you the airplane. We brought you economics. We brought you electricity. We brought you running water. We brought you medicine. And we brought you a longer life expectancy. Right. So you're welcome.
Who did you bring this to? I mean, because my grandfather was Cherokee.
Yeah. Well, in this context, is about the Indians who were living here before they got conquered.
Right. And got wiped out. So you didn't really bring him anything short of death.
Well, in fairness, Mother Nature did most of that for us because she's a vindictive bitch. So yeah,
but they were also giving them like blankets of smallpox and all sorts of shit to get rid of. But I guess my point is, bring him anything. It's not like people came here and it's like, hey, we're going to teach you how to do all this stuff and we're going to bring you all this technology. It was a wipeout.
Hello, locals. We bring you cool baubles from Europe you will enjoy.
But no,
gather around. Let me show you how to use this.
No, seriously, because I've heard this a lot. And Jamal, I'm glad that you brought this up because I'm generally curious about this.
Go for it.
No, we always hear about the blankets with smallpox. However, before the late 1800s, people didn't know what germs were. There was no idea. Back in the 1700s, Enlightenments, we were still going with the miasma theory that diseases are spread by bad air.
Yeah.
So then how would the Europeans know that if they took infected blankets, that would do something? Because remember, at the time, they were still going on Galen's assumptions that it was the bad air was making people sick. Mm-hmm. There were no germs. There was no immunogen. I mean, there was no study of the immune system because no one had any idea what the hell the immune system was.
They didn't identify germs, but they definitely had they were very observant people, in many ways more observant than we are. And, you know, for example, during the Black Death, They observed that people seemed to recover better if they were in a room that was painted red or draped with red curtains. And that sounds ridiculous to us now. It turns out that actually the light treatment with the red spectrum of light does actually help with a lot of illnesses, including the plague. And so,
wasn't Pope Clement in Avignon who had the two big bonfires going on, yep, on either side of his throne?
So I think that I think that the smallpox blanket thing may be slightly overstated.
Or a lot.
But I think that basically they knew, I think they kind of knew, like, if you know, this thing was next to a person who was sick and you give it to someone else is next to it, they might get sick too. Yeah.
And one thing also,
the idea of the cooties principle, you know?
Yeah. And the one thing I do also want to point out, and then we'll end because I know we're going long. Ghani Beg, he's widely considered the father of germ warfare, because when he was besieging Kaffa there in the Crimea,
yeah,
they would catapult corpses of plague victims over the walls, because they knew that rotting meat and stuff would make people sick. They didn't know how, they didn't know the mechanics.
Right.
But the Mongols straight up went full biological warfare. To say that European traders did that, that's a bit far.
Well, the Mongols also, I think they may have actually known, because they invaded and occupied the Emirate of Samarkand, which was the center of science in the entire world. And they had the Tajiks who lived there at the time, they kind of did know about germs.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, but I guess that's just the whole point that I'm making, though, right? Is that we always hear, oh, those damn white people and those blankets. Bitch, please read about the Mongols, then get back to me.
I mean, look,
it was still a wipeout.
It's still a genocide. Even if you take the blankets out, I guess my point to you is, the people in anywhere around the globe, in any particular population, mm-hmm, is perfectly fine. It's, you know, whether those people are advancing at the rate of speed that you think they should advance at, that's kind of besides the point. You're not bringing me the wheel. You're not bringing me literacy or whatever the hell they'd supposed to be bringing. You're bringing death because you want to take the land. It's not...
I live 15 miles north of the Flathead Indian Reservation. I guarantee you the Indians that live there have got schools. They're educated. They got wheels. They're living a much better life than what their ancestors did. And I submit to you.
Because it's 2026, right?
Well, of course. They should have those things.
But that's the point that I'm making, though, right? I mean, the whole myth of the noble savage, it's just that. It's a myth. So let's just say that the Indians were here on North America for 7,000 years before Whitey showed up. They still have the wheel. They're still Stone Age people. The point that I'm making is that my ancestors are always villainized as being these genocidal maniacs.
Well, the questioner wasn't saying that. The questioner was saying that you guys were more of a nuisance than his people. Nuisance is defined nuisance, right?
Well, that's the whole thing, right? And I'm advocating that we did a lot more good than bad.
Okay. How many people needs to die for that good to take place? I guess that's the rub. I mean, because look, the reality of it is,
there is no way to know. I have no idea.
But that's the rub. There's no way to know that had not those people been killed, that technology and everything else would have still progressed.
But like, we don't know. Like, because it happened. No, they didn't have any way. They really didn't have any way meaningfully traveling, exchanging information. In Mesoamerica, the Aztecs had these pyramids where they were performing human sacrifices by ripping out people's hearts. You travel north for 4 months into what's now Nebraska. You have people using dog chavoys, using pictographs. So I mean, there was no cross pollination. That's the point that I'm trying to make here.
But there was cross pollination.
Well, there had to be because there was trade across the continent.
But for example, we know that the Romans traded with the Persians. We know that the printing press was originally invented in China, and then Gutenberg kind of did his own thing. We know that the Eastern Roman Empire became more Persian, became more Eastern as time went on because of the cultural, just the intercourse between those two civilizations. That was made possible because of the horse. The Indians didn't have that. That's the point that I'm making here, is that they were technologically backwards. And that's the
so what? I mean, that doesn't mean they were miserable.
What does it matter? So if Donald Trump goes into Iran, murders, I don't know, 30 million people, takes over the country, and 200 years later, they are, you know, some kind of space colony from Iran, that doesn't make it okay. Just because you can advance technologically by murdering hundreds of thousands of people, et cetera, that doesn't make the murder okay.
Yeah, didn't say it did. But what I'm saying is that is the human condition, is that whenever one group of people comes in and they're able to dominate, you know, either culturally or militarily, or in this case, both, people are going to be people. I mean, conquest is an integral part of the human condition. That is a statement of fact. And that's the point that I'm trying to make here.
If that's the case, then we shouldn't care about Trump. We shouldn't care about the war.
But if we're just comparing nuisances, but anyway, guys, we're over. We're almost 10 minutes over. So we should wrap it.
JT, this obviously, is fun.
There's obviously a demand for Q&A.
I love this, by the way.
Me too. Guys, it's so fun. Okay, I'm looking forward to seeing you again, both of you, tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. Eastern Time. The program is Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. Eastern Time, with myself and Jermall Thomas. And not so occasionally, Robbie West, our producer. We will do another complete Q&A show this coming Wednesday, again, 12 noon Eastern. And thanks, everyone, for your support. Please like, follow, and share the show. And not to put too fine a point on it, your financial contributions are probably never going to be more necessary or more appreciated than they are now. Thanks a lot.